Hi, my name's Chris Sanek. I am going to be presenting a talk on how I finally made my first video game, or as I might have called it if I was more interested in being accurate, how I am finally making my first video game. Still working on it. The experience is kind of a long story, so I'll just get right into it. To tell you a little bit about myself, I had my first computer exposure roughly 1980-81. My parents got an Atari 2600 for Christmas, and at some point in first grade I had my first encounter with an Apple II. Later on in second grade I got to play around on Commodore 64s and messed around in Logo and BASIC. So I got some fairly early BASIC programming knowledge and skill, not terribly advanced, and I've spent about the last 10 years doing various IT roles, primarily user support and system administration. I'm not a great programmer by any means, and I just wanted to point this out because when I was putting this presentation together and gave a couple friends some advanced look at my slides, they said, don't sell yourself short by saying this, but I just wanted to say it because it's true, first of all, but also it's very possible for you to do pretty cool things even if you're not great. And you have to start somewhere, so at maybe age six, I was closer to the left end of the slide, and now I'm where I'm at, and someday maybe I'll get down towards infinity. But no matter how good I get at doing what I do, I have never really been satisfied, and I always want to do better. So I'll tell you some backstory. This is going to be a really hard section of the talk for me to go into because it's very tempting to just spew my entire life story, and I want to try to keep it on track. But Christmas 1980-81, I don't remember which year exactly, but I think it was 81. My parents got us an Atari, and I had my first experience playing video games and was pretty much hooked instantly. I also, does anyone recognize these, by the way? I'm not sure of the age range. These are Chuck E. Cheese tokens. Four times a year, every time I got a report card, I would go down to the local Chuck E. Cheese establishment, and I would get to play arcade games for free because they gave you tokens for A's and B's. So I always got a lot of tokens that way, and had a lot of fun playing all the classic early 80s games, you know, Pac-Man, Ms. Pac-Man, Moon Patrol, Defender, Asteroids, Galaxian, Galaga, Dig Dug, Tempest, Kix, and so on. So I love those kind of games. I have been a lifelong gamer, and I like pretty much every type of game that there is. I have criticisms about some types of games and other types of games I have kind of gotten out of touch with, but for the most part I've tried everything that I could get my hands on, and I've enjoyed a lot of them. So these are some of the games that I was influenced by. My first game, which I'll be talking about in my presentation here, is something of a combination between, say, Pac-Man and Dig Dug and maybe Defender. And maybe you'll see those influences in it when I demo. Maybe you'll see other things. I also spent a lot of time in my childhood up in my bedroom reading Choose Your Own Adventure books and playing, not really playing so much as reading Dungeons & Dragons rule books. I didn't have a whole lot of friends who were into role-playing games. I didn't really get to play as much as I got to read. And I would spend a lot of time just going over the rule books again and again and figuring out how they worked and thinking, this doesn't make sense. I want this to work differently. This rule just doesn't work for me. I'm going to change it. And coming up with a lot of different custom mechanics that I didn't really get to play much with other kids, but in my mind made the game better. So I kind of had this instinct for game design. coming out of me at an early age without really realizing it, just sort of naturally engaging in the stuff around me. I put the cover for the Choose Your Own Adventure book up that I did because it's a particular favorite of mine. There is a section in the book throughout the story as you go through this one. They mention this utopian place where you can't go to by making decisions. And sure enough, there's no way to get to the pages that describe it unless you just flip to the right page. There's no actual, you know, turn to this page and then you get there. You just sort of have to discover it by kind of cheating and going through the book and finding it. It's like an Easter egg. So I also played with Legos a lot. And I never really built the thing on the box, you know, the picture of the thing that you were buying the kit for. I always built my own thing. Usually vehicles, adventure, military type vehicles, and played with those endlessly, and probably spent as much time, if not more, actually building them as I did playing with them, and I still have most of them. So, I initially started doing game design on paper because I didn't have a full-blown computer at home, we just had the Atari. And so what I would do when I wasn't playing games or watching TV, I would sit with a large sheaf of fanfold computer paper that one of my uncles worked for some bank, and they had these line print feeds coming off of their printers that they no longer needed, and rather they didn't have a recycling program or anything. So they were printed on one side, the other side was blank, and it was drawing paper. So because it was computer paper, it made me think that it was more computery than regular drawing paper. And I would draw concepts for games that I wish they would make. And then I would take them to my mom, and I would tell her about what the game was and tell her a story, and she would write everything down on it. And that was my first foray into game design. Sadly, most of the original conceptual documents no longer survive. I went to my parents' house. At one time, all this stuff was up in my attic at my parents' house. And a couple of years ago, my mom got into scrapbooking and didn't think that they were of particular value, but she took a lot of school assignments and photos and stuff like that, cut them all up and put them in these photo albums, and got rid of everything else. So unfortunately, there really doesn't... most of the stuff that I still have is in my head. So the one thing that did survive was a game concept called Bunny Bots. If you look at this, it kind of is reminiscent of Lemmings, but I did it in 1982. I don't know when Lemmings came out offhand. I think it was more like 89-ish, 90, something like that. This was a game where you had like these little bunny robots that were kind of anthropomorphic bunnies that had a war. Everything that I did when I was a little kid was kind of war-themed. I was really big into World War II hardware and Hogan's Heroes and war movies and stuff like that. So I always had things with bazookas and helicopters and tanks and stuff. So the interesting thing about this game was that you weren't controlling any one particular bunny bot. You were kind of controlling the army. So it had like elements of real-time strategy in it. And it hadn't been invented yet, but that was one of the things I imagined. So this is not the game that I made or am making, but we'll talk about that real soon. I did most of my game design concepts with either freehand drawing, just with a pencil, or one of these, which is, this is an architect's template. And I had no idea what architects actually did with it other than drafting something to do with building floor plans, but I used these shapes. They seemed like they were good graphical elements. I just put different shapes together and use a straight edge and make my graphics look like combinations of these things. So I was kind of obsessed with video games for most of my childhood. It was one of my major activities, along with softball and bicycling, and I spent a lot of time playing Atari and NES especially. I never really got into Sega, but I had an Atari 2600, later a 7800, then we got an NES and a Super Nintendo, And then by the time the N64 came out, I was in college, and I had less time for playing, but I still game on PC and Mac platforms, and I have a large collection at home of games, not this big, but pretty close. And I still play them. So by the time I was getting ready to go to college, I was expecting that I was going to become a computer science major and study programming and then start making video games. And I didn't really know how I would get a job doing that, but I just expected that that would kind of fall together. And my parents were like, well, you really should think about doing things that are practical, because I don't think video game design is really a job. I don't think anyone actually does that. And of course, there's companies making these things, and people work for companies, and somebody's got a job doing that, but they just didn't encourage me or make it a realistic expectation that it's something I could do. They were like, well, you could study business or law or something. And I was like, well, I don't really want to do that. So by the time I got to college, though, I was a little bit behind with computers, despite having the early exposure to the systems that I did and learning a little bit about programming. Our school didn't modernize. We were still programming Pascal on Apple IIs in 1993. That was a little bit backwards, perhaps. My first exposure to a computer that actually had a mouse and a hard drive and an operating system was not until I bought my first Mac. And then I had a whole lot of learning to do about system maintenance and tweaking and updates and how to install software and all this stuff. And on top of that, I had reading and homework assignments for other classes. And by the time I got done with all that, the amount of time left over for learning computer science was not so big. And at the same time, there were these kids who were coming from overseas, like India, and they did rote memorization of CE, and they had like ANSI C memorized already by the time they walked in the door as freshmen, and I was intimidated. I was like, this is the sort of thing that these people can do, and I can never imagine myself even coming close to this. So I kind of switched gears and ended up being an English philosophy major. Also in 1993, there was this stuff going on with alternative culture, and I don't know if anybody remembers the movie Wayne's World. The plot of that was sort of like this, you know, Wayne's got this public access TV show that he's having fun with, and this corporate guy comes and like tries to buy him out and sponsor him and make him more famous, but then he ends up stealing the show from him and making it something that corrupted his original vision. And I was very conscious about this sort of stuff. The alternative music scene kind of backed this as well, with a lot of messages about selling out and not doing that and having artistic integrity, whatever that means. At the same time, I saw a lot of things changing in the game industry, where originally back in the early 80s, projects were small. People wrote things for Atari 2600 that fit in 4K of ROM. And it was conceivable that one person could develop a game by themselves. And you had people like Lord British who did that, where they would do the game design, the concept for the game, the rules, the graphics, the sound, and everything, the programming, all by themselves, and or in small teams where they were working pretty closely with each other. And by the time the 90s came out, computer systems were large enough that they could support a style of game that was too large for one person to crank out in a reasonable amount of time. So it started to go with more team-based things, people were specializing, and I started seeing game production and game development as being something that would corrupt any single person's vision and turn it into either a team thing or the dreaded outcome of a lot of games was commodification and turning into something that would sell. So there was a lot of sequels. Games were becoming pretty big ticket items to produce in million-dollar budgets and tens of millions of dollars in some cases, and companies weren't willing to take risks and allow a person to pursue a dream and come up with something that was unique. You know, you had to have some established market for a game based on previous games that were successful. And so you had the codification of genre, where if it wasn't a first-person shooter, if it wasn't in 3D in the 90s, people weren't interested in making it all of a sudden. And it wasn't the style of gaming that I particularly liked. And I kind of fell out of favor with the notion that this was going to be something that I could do with my life. So I kind of shelved the dream for a long time. I questioned whether this was something I wanted to do with myself, so I put it aside, graduated, thought about going to film school for graduate study, didn't do that, ended up playing around with computers on my own until I sort of ended up with this accidental IT career that is still going on. And I never really gave up the dream for coming up with a game somehow. I just, every couple months or every board meeting that I sat in, I would be doodling, writing down ideas for how to make this game. I had no idea how I was actually going to put it together. I didn't have confidence in my ability to learn programming. I had tried a number of times, and I always found it really difficult. And the tools at the time were a lot worse than they are now. So it was hard. So I just kind of kept thinking about it, but I never really got anywhere. So that was my life for about the 20s, the decade of the 20s and the first half of the 30s. Around 2005, though, I started to become aware of this thing called independent game development. And so you had kind of a resurgence of retro games. Like, people my age remembered games that they played when they were young and were like, oh, nostalgia. And so you started seeing a lot more repackaging of old games, and then new games started coming out that were kind of in homage to the gameplay style that was prevalent, you know, in the early 80s when I was really first into games. And so I started thinking, well, maybe this is something I could do. I still didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what tools were out there or anything like that. And didn't really have much of an idea. But in 2006, my career kind of took a turn towards software development, where I had been doing system administration for a number of years. And then our team had a developer leave. And I worked in supporting a lot of the custom applications that our team built. And we had a lot of problems with buggy applications or poor user interfaces and so forth. So in the course of assisting users with the software that they were building, I would often bring back suggestions to the team on how something could be designed better, or would have been nice if you provided some user documentation so people would actually know how to use the software. And by the way, I can't support the software unless I know how to use the software, so maybe bring me in while you're developing and kind of get me up to speed with it before you release so I can actually support it better. And they finally got sick of me giving them all these suggestions. It's like, if you're so smart, why don't you figure out how to do it yourself? And so I kind of started doing software development in my job. I tried to do a game in 2007. I took a Java class at a community college in the fall of 2006 and did well in it. And then the next semester, I tried doing a game and actually tried taking a class on making games in Java, but ended up not doing so good at that. And then just last year, I took another game course at a different community college. If anyone here is local, Lorain County has a decent program on game design and computer simulation design. I took the intro course there, and they taught GameMaker, which I'll talk about a little bit, but we'll probably reserve more of the technical stuff for the breakout session after this. But anyway, I took a class and did well, and I enjoyed it, and then I was like, okay, I learned how to do stuff. I actually know how to make a game now. I need to do something with that in order to further develop my skills. So what did I do? I went back to the very beginning, and the game that stuck in my mind was this game that I called Booby Teeth, which turns out to be a pretty good title for a game, because every time I tell it to people, they smile or laugh, and then they tell me it's an awesome title. I was worried about it because I was like, well, it has the word booby in it, and I wasn't sure how that would fly, but it turns out it also has a lot of SEO potential, because I Googled it 2 days after I put it up on the web, and it was the number one hit. I'll tell you about the game a little bit. Better late than never. That's Duke Nukem, by the way. The people working for the Duke Nukem team have nothing on me when it comes to procrastination. It's only been, what, 17 years for Duke? And I've been at this for 30, and I'm still not released yet. But the game is about a fish. Booby Teeth is a corruption of, well, I used to watch a lot of cartoons. You know, Bugs Bunny, they have Elmer Fudd stepping in a bear trap. And I thought the bear trap was called a booby trap. So in my original drawing, which no longer survives, the fish that I drew had, you know, big, massive jaws with sharp teeth that looked like a bear trap. So I called the game Booby Teeth, because I thought booby trap teeth. And anyway, so there's proof. There's a real fish and with real teeth that are really scary. And then on the top, on the right side, there is the template elements from that architectural template that I turned into a fish. And then below that is the actual sprite from my game, which is perhaps not the final sprite of the game, but it works enough for now. The concept is very simple. You're a fish, and you eat smaller fish, and bigger fish try to eat you, and you try to avoid that from happening. That's basically it. In 1980, that was enough for a plot. I'm going to show you this movie now, and this is going to show you a lot of different stages of release from 01 to now. So in the early concepts, I didn't really have a lot programmed. I just wanted to show that I could move around and interact with other objects. And so I just, I'm going to hit pause there. The game there, you just saw, you ate something smaller than you, and then you crashed into a bigger thing, and it ate you. I had a lot of things going on, and rather than pause in between each one of these, I just have like title screens that explain everything. If you guys can read, it'll probably be faster. This is about 6 minutes of video, and I just want to get through it so that we can continue the talk. Oh, I'm sorry. We skipped ahead. That was not the next version that I released. I'm gonna see if I can go back. Okay, so let's just watch. So these first couple versions didn't have any sound to them, which is why they're silent. And rather than read all the titles to you, I think I'll just let them go, because I don't have them timed for me to read them quickly enough. So this was the first version where the enemies moved. This was version 4. We have about 17 versions in this film, so this is version 5. I just made a title screen for it. There was a reason why I had to do that, which I'll talk about later. Then in version 6, I needed to do some instrumentation so I could actually see what was going on and fix bugs. I also introduced the concept of leveling up, going to a higher difficulty level. And I had some graphics bugs, so I took a step back and didn't have the scale factor changing the size of the sprites. But I was at least able to display the size and speed on the screen. In version 7, I came out with sound, and then up in the top left, you'll see there's a dashboard which tells you what level you're on, what your score is, and how big you are. And I also made the sprites rectangular so they'd be more fish-like. And then in version 8, I had an automatic level advance condition, and I did some performance optimizations. And it didn't look any different, so you're not going to actually see the video, but it played faster. Version 9, I made the movement rotational instead of orthogonal, so you can see that you're now twisting and turning as you navigate the screen instead of going up, down, left, right. And then I added some eye candy to display the score when you actually eat a fish. Now, when the fish is destroyed, you get a graphic that tells you how many points you scored for it, and it gives you a little point multiplier that if your multiplier goes up, the fish value goes up. And so at this point, I was struggling with getting the AI to work, because at the moment, the fish are just moving in a straight line without any kind of interaction with their environment at all. And I could not get that to work for a long time. I ended up reading a lot and still couldn't get it to work. But then I decided, well, I'll do other things. So I added this color background, which made it more aquatic looking. And then I finally decided to replace the rectangular sprites with fish-shaped sprites. And I made a large room that scrolls, and when you go deep, it actually gets darker, which was kind of cool. And in versions 15 through 17, I added a sea level, some waves at the surface, and sky. And this, we have audio here at this point, but it's evidently not playing through. Maybe if I unmute. And I don't think I'm mic'd up to anything, actually. I forgot to hook the speakers up. But afterwards, when we do the breakout session, anyone who wants to come up can see it. So in version 17, I actually implemented the lighting system, which is very primitive, but it does the job for now. You're going to see him go down deep, and it's going to get darker. So by the time I got to version 18, I had to rework basically most of what I did. I learned a lot about the language that I was working in, and the stuff that I had built so far was okay, but it needed to be cleaned up a lot. So the next couple versions dealt a lot with getting those issues under control so that I could keep the project manageable and keep moving forward with a steady amount of progress. Because otherwise, if you don't do that, when your project gets to a certain size, it just becomes complex. And if you don't manage that complexity, you're going to get bogged down in a lot of bug fixing and trying to sort out how to make things work together right, and then you just never get anywhere. Okay, so that's the end of that video, and then the next video is going to be just a quick montage of clips from the recent couple builds that I did in the last few days, where I now have working AI. So the fish get hungry, they seek out a fish that is smaller than them to eat, and then they go after it and eat it, and when they are no longer hungry, they stop eating. When when they're close to you, they'll eat you too. So it's a lot more fun and interesting to play this way now. And I also added these fish up at the top that I call feeder fish. They're my first special fish in the game. The other ones are kind of randomly generated and seeded at the beginning of the level. And the feeder fish are too, but the neat thing about the feeder fish is they eat each other. And when they get to a certain size level, they turn into regular fish. And so it just gives a different element to the game and makes it more realistic. It also gives the AI fish reason to kind of come toward the top to feed, which is like kind of how natural fish feed in the real world. And it gives the game kind of a little bit of a realistic sense to it. And this is all just action shots showing off how the AI behave under different conditions. And it just looks kind of cool. It's like watching an aquarium. So getting the AI to work in this was actually pretty hard to accomplish, mainly because I didn't understand the environment that I was programming in well enough at the time, and I had to figure that out, and the documentation that I needed to understand how to do the things I wanted to do was not really well written and not that easy to understand. There is a property that each one of these objects in the game has, which is an ID value. That is how you identify it to do things like, for example, target it. And getting that ID is tricky, at least in terms of if you read the instructions in the help file, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And once you understand how to do it, it's not that bad. But it took a lot of reading and rereading and going to forums and asking for help and so on to get information. But I did finally figure it out, as you can see. So I think that's the end of the video. Next slide, I'm going to talk about the tools that I used to produce this. GameMaker, Paige spoke about in her presentation as well. It's a pretty nice rapid development platform for novice programmers as well as non-technical people who are just, you know, a game designer or an artist who want to do game making. It's not just programmers that can do this now. It's like you can do this all through very simple drag and drop methods. I'm going to step out in front here so I can laser at the screen. This area here shows you like a list of all your elements or assets for your game. So you have different categories. You have sprites, sound effects, background images. I'm going to skip over paths because I don't really use them in this game. Scripts, which are your code files that actually control different things and make stuff happen. Fonts for drawing text to the screen. Timelines for scripting out when scripted events happen. And then objects, which are a lot of different things. Anything, any type of graphical element on the game is going to be represented by an object. And then there's invisible objects as well that you can program to do things like control and manage data in the background and all sorts of stuff like that. And then there's rooms, which a room is basically a level or a virtual environment where your game is taking place. And your game might consist of one room or many rooms. And your rooms can also do duty for like configuration screens and high score screens and stuff like that. So each room fits in a window, and then you can make views which show you a part of that room or the entire room scaled down or different things like that. In the middle area here,
I happen to be looking at the object for the player object. This is the Booby Teeth character, and he has a bunch of different events that are thrown at different conditions in the game, like when he's created or during each step in the game engine, each tick of the game clock, these step events take place, and then there's these things here which are collision events for the enemy fish and the feeder fish object, and then there's control events for when you hit the left and right keys on the keypad, or the left button on the mouse. If you mouse over the fish and left click, it gives you properties for the fish. It'll tell you the current size that you are and what your speed is, and I think that's it. And then I have two triggers that I built, which turn gravity on and off when you're above water. If you jump out of the above surface, gravity is in effect, and it pulls you back down. And then when you're underwater, you're buoyant against it, I turn gravity off. So there's all these actions. Like in the create event here, you can see I have one action, which it's misleading because it's actually a script, and the script does a lot of stuff. But it's I found a lot easier to produce a game by writing scripts than it is to use the drag and drop stuff. Drag and drop's really good when you're starting out, just learning, and you can do things very quickly that way. But once you get good with the language, it's better to convert all the drag and drop stuff that you can into scripts, because then you can reuse the scripts, modify them more easily, and so forth. For a $25 product, it's pretty good. It's quick and easy to build things. It has a really nice learning curve where they have tutorials and demos and a community with forums, and you can learn a lot on your own. I got into it through the class that I took at Lorain Community College, but I really could have picked it up. There's a nice book out there also called The Game Maker's Apprentice, which has very detailed tutorials that tell you exactly step by step how to make a sample game, and is really good to learn from. We use that in the class, and we did more with it than what they told us in the book, but you can do a full-fledged game from the book. As you learn, its capabilities kind of expose themselves to you in a natural sort of way. So like, for example, I was talking about how I transitioned from doing stuff through drag and drop actions, and then switching over to game maker language to do scripting. That sort of happened naturally. I didn't get to a point where I was stuck and frustrated and couldn't do it. I was like, how do I do this? And I started reading, and then I was like, oh, okay, you can script this stuff. I can code a little bit already because I've done that, and I wonder how you do that. So I read the language specification and figured it out, and it was not too bad. And there's a pretty decent community around the platform. The community forums are relatively good. I've posted questions there and gotten several responses back within a couple hours, and that's pretty nice. And they've been helpful. So it's not like, I guess it helps if you know how to ask questions, but you do get good help when you ask them correctly. The cons to using it is it's a scripted language that it uses, and it's somewhat slow compared to doing it with a lower level language. Like if you wanted to do something very complicated, like a 3D game, you're probably going to run into a lot of performance issues until you really learn how to optimize your scripts, because they do not get interpreted by the runtime very quickly. I don't know if it's a con or not, but it's a little bit of a con if you're trying to teach somebody object-oriented programming, because it's actually object-based rather than object-oriented. And so there's some kind of misconceptions that you might teach somebody if you're trying to teach them object-oriented programming. But that's not really the goal for Game Maker, so maybe it's not a con. All variables in your objects are public, so there's no such thing as private variables. It's one of the bad things that they teach you. You can directly access anything from anywhere, and it really messes you up if you're ready to graduate into another language and you have to learn how to do that and be a little bit more disciplined with your programming. And it's also got a fairly weak debugging environment. It doesn't really have any kind of traceability, like where you can step through code. But it does have like a quick watch utility that you can see what the state of your variables is at different points. And I find that that is minimally useful, so I have to do a lot of stuff with instrumenting my code. I built logging into my application so I can actually see what events are happening when I do something. I quit the game, I go back to the log and say, oh yeah, it did happen in the right order that I thought it was going to happen in, and stuff like that. But I had to build all that myself. So, and then their data typing is kind of weird. It's very simple, and it's actually a strength if you're not a programmer. But they only have two data types. There's real numbers, and there's strings, and that's it. There's no integers. There's no business with floats and doubles and any of that stuff. There's no characters. It's just a string or a real. And you can do Booleans, and there's a reserved word for true and a reserved word for false, but they're just placeholders for one and zero. And so when you're doing certain types of operations where you want to be type safe, you're really not. And you have to catch that. And it can get you into trouble, especially if you're not a careful programmer or kind of new to it. It can trip you up. But at the same time, because you don't have to worry about a lot of that type safe stuff, it makes it easier to do some very basic things. And that might be a strength for a new developer. But I kind of rate it as a con. For sound effects, I have used this SFXR utility that was made by a guy named Dr. Petter for the Ludlum Dare competition, which was an independent game maker competition. And it's just a really nice utility for making old school kind of sound effects that sound like an 8-bit sound chip made them. And you can do square waves, sine waves, sawtooth waves, and noise. And they have a lot of pre-built generator functions that can give you different types of sound for explosions and getting a power up or getting hit, jumping. And you can edit them and tweak them to your preference and then save them or export them into a WAV file. And GameMaker works natively with WAV files, so it's really easy to export something from SFXR, bring it into your GameMaker project, and then start using it. I also, for graphics, GameMaker has its own built-in sprite editor, which is pretty decent. For some stuff, I find it easier to work in Paint.net, which is a Windows .NET application that is a very nice free Photoshop Lite kind of application. There's also the GIMP, if you're into the GIMP. I like Paint because it's a little bit easier to get up and running with, but GIMP is nice too. And then whatever other programs are out there, but this is the one I happen to use. And so I'll talk about my process a little bit. How I do what I do is not that complicated. I'm a one-person team. I do everything, and I tell myself what to do, when to do it, and how to do it, so it's really fun. And I don't have to deal with a lot of BS from working with a team or having a manager or anything like that. I'm just very driven to do this and actually make it happen now that I have the capability and can do it. It's no problem for me to get motivated and actually sit down and crank it out. So I'll sit down in the evening after work, and I'll just work on it after dinner for all night. I like to work in kind of long and uninterrupted sessions. Anywhere from 4 to 6 hours. The last couple days I've been doing like all day long just to get the game as good as it could be for the conference today. So I was pulling like 14-hour to 18-hour days, which is not typical, but I like to work uninterrupted. So I start with a vague list of ideas, and this is just like something I had in my head at one point, and then every time I come up with something, I write it down. So I'm really big on documenting everything that I do. So I can keep track of stuff, and I every time I revisit a thought that I had before, I find that I rethink it, and I might rethink it differently. And if I build stuff that relies on how I thought about it 6 weeks ago, and I'm now thinking about it differently today, when I go to use that thing that I built with the assumptions that I had 6 weeks ago, and I forgot about what those assumptions were because I didn't write it down, I get into trouble. So I just write everything down. I write down what I was trying to do, why I was doing it, and then it helps me when I go back to it later on to know exactly. It puts me back into the same frame of mind again, so I can catch whatever misassumptions that I might have had by revisiting the notion or rethinking it. So I take one of my things off of my list, and I decide to work on it and focus on it. And so I build it, test it, tweak it. Once I have it working correctly and I'm satisfied with it for now, I freeze code at that point. I document everything that I did. I have like a backlog list of things that I need to do still, and I cross the thing off or update it. And then I write it into like I have a history list of this is what's in this build. And then I also have comments in the code itself that tell me how things are supposed to work or what else might need to be done with them later and that kind of thing. And I find all that very helpful. So after I get done documenting everything, I make sure it's all accurate, complete. Then I build it a final time and then I put it up on my website, which I don't know if you guys have seen the business cards that I laid around about the talk, but there's a URL for my website and you can go and download the latest release and play it. You're encouraged to do so. And I would like to hear feedback if you happen to play it and have thoughts, either ideas for what you would like to see done with it, or if you didn't like something about it, or if you had a bug, it crashed on you, it didn't work, something. Please let me know and I'll try to look at it and see what I can do. So what did I learn off from this? I learned that I was ready. Actually, I could have done this a long time ago. A lot of the intimidation I had from college was kind of misplaced and unfortunate, but I also learned that I wasn't ready in a lot of ways because I keep learning new things. I keep running into things that I don't know how to do, and that's good. I like learning, and I like being challenged. I like figuring out stuff. It's really rewarding to sit down and think, how would I do this? I don't even know. And then think about it a little bit more and kind of come up with an idea for, yeah, that would probably work. I'll try that. And then trying it and seeing, yeah, it did work. And then, but it didn't quite work. So what else do I need to do here to make it really work the right way? And then doing that and then refining the process until it finally works. That's a really rewarding thing. I started laughing when I saw the AI finally work. It was like 3 a.m. and I was alone in the house and I just couldn't stop laughing because it was finally working. It was like a mad scientist moment. So I also learned that now is the best time. Like any time that you can do things is now. You can't do things in the past and you could do them later, but why? Because later is just going to be now at some point. So do it now. Just a quick raise of hands, is this everybody's not first time being at this conference, or is there anyone in here for the first time? Okay, so your homework assignment is I want you to come back next year, and I want you to put in a proposal for a talk. You don't have to, but if you don't, I want you to bring someone else next time. Someone who could not be here today really inspired me just by being nice to me when I was at Nauticon 6. Neon Rain is her name, and I'm sorry she can't be here. She's going through some personal stuff, but she was actually nice and approached me. She was a speaker and was really friendly, just made me feel included in a way that hadn't happened yet up until the point when she did that. So now that you guys kind of know my life story in short form, I hope that you guys can treat me the same way if you need a friend in the scene or just someone to talk to, give you encouragement. If there isn't something that you feel like you can talk to in front of a room of people that you love to do or think about or whatever, I think that's kind of sad. So everybody's got to have something, and I want you to think about what that thing is and then submit a talk proposal for next year. Now is the best time. So take small steps, make them frequently, make a lot of steps, and then start right away. Programming is not that hard. A lot of the basic stuff that I learned when I was 7 is still the fundamentals of, you know, flow control, if-then statements, loop statements, making functions that you can call and reuse, variables, data types, all that stuff is very simple and not that hard to get even when you're seven. Object-oriented programming is a little bit harder, but again, not that difficult. What's actually hard, though, is trying to figure out how to make something work when you've never seen it work before and you have nothing to go on. So actually looking at the real world and trying to dissect something and figure out what the steps are, breaking the problem down and designing a solution that will actually do what you want to do can be hard. Knowing the language that you're using makes it easier, but learning the language that you're trying to use can be hard. You have to be able to read the documentation, and I have to read it over and over and over again in order to get stuff to where I understand it sometimes. But I eventually do get it, and if I don't, I can go to people who know more than me. There's a whole internet out there of them, and they help. Making games is a lot more than just programming. You have to kind of be able to do everything, or you have to be able to work with a team that can do everything. If you don't know how to proceed, the best thing to do if you're not confident about how to proceed is do anything and then watch and just figure out why it's failing. You're going to fail a zillion times before you succeed, so just do the smallest, simplest part of what you think you need to do that might possibly work and then do it. Run it, learn from what it does, and then iterate and get closer until you finally figure it out. It's just a lot of time and effort. I also learned you really need to do what you were meant to do in life. This is kind of like an awakening thing for me. I learned that I was meant to be a video game designer. And whether I make money at it or not, that's what I'm going to do with my life. You have to also be a fiend. If you're going to work on something that's your passion, you have to be a fiend. You have to read like a fiend, code like a fiend, and test like a fiend in order to make a game. If I didn't read generally, I wouldn't have the background in life to know the types of things that are fun or cool or interesting to make a game out of. If I didn't code a lot, I wouldn't get good at it, and I wouldn't make anything. So, and if I didn't test it a lot, it wouldn't stand up. I talked about documenting and everything. I'm kind of running short on time, so I'm going to skip this. But this is a screenshot from the movie Memento. The guy tattooed all the things he needed to remember on his body because he had no memory. Making mistakes is fun. It's good to do it. And you need to do it in order to learn. So don't be afraid of making mistakes. Just watch them and learn from them. And if you don't know how to do something exactly, fake it. There's so much in old games that I thought was actually intelligent modeled behavior that's actually just math. And not that complicated math either. Like the way the ghosts move around in Pac-Man, it's all math. There's no mystery behind it, but it's a good fake artificial intelligence, and it's all you need in a lot of cases. So also refactor at every opportunity. This is what I learned around version 16, 17, when I realized my project was getting too complicated and I needed to simplify it. And if I didn't do that, if you put it off longer, your code's just going to get uglier and more difficult to manage. So the soonest time that you see an opportunity to refactor and do something better, do it. If you don't have the time, absolutely, to not do it, at least put a note in yourself, like a to-do comment, to do this at some point, and then make it a point to do it at your earliest opportunity. Learning how to ask for help is important. You need to be able to do that, so knowing how to ask questions on forums and get useful answers is important. I'll save how to do that for the breakout if anyone wants to talk to me about it. And just talk to people. So much happens when you talk to people. I got a job interview by talking to somebody about the game project. It didn't pan out and turn into a job, but it was exciting to have that happen. And it happened a lot earlier than I thought it would, just because I happened to be at an event talking to other coders, and I was like, oh, this is what I'm working on. I also was talking to a girl at a party, and she was like, you're interesting. You're not like all these other people here. I was like, really? That never happened before. So just talk to people about what you're working on and what you're into, and you'll find out a lot of people share your ideas or values or interests, and you'll get ideas from them, and it's rewarding anyway. Don't worry about whether it'll make money. Just do something cool first. And I don't have any business plan or anything for my game. I'm just releasing it because it's fun, and I want people to enjoy it, and I want to prove to myself that I can do it. And that's the best thing. Like, once you do something cool, you can figure out how to make money from it eventually, if you have any kind of business mind. If you don't, it doesn't really matter that much. Just enjoying doing it for the love of doing it is a big reward in itself. And you got to do things that you want to do happily for free. Like, if you can imagine being this guy and the only reason you look like that is because someone paid you, you wouldn't be very happy. But if this is what he wants to do and this is what makes him happy, then go for it. And try everything at least once. If you do this, you'll figure out what you're good at. You'll also figure out how to talk to people who are good at the things that you're not good at. And that will make you more valuable in a team operation. So there's no better way to learn something than to try it. And finally, your obsession is you. If you don't follow your passions, you're not going to be happy in life. And whatever you become obsessed with will become your life regardless. So it's better to just embrace that and live it. And if you don't have the type of people around you who will support that, find people who will and be around them. That's it. If you want to attend a hands-on demo after this talk, I will be upstairs for the next hour or so, and then I'm getting dinner. So I'm looking for playtesting feedback primarily, but if anyone is interested in collaborating in any fashion, I'm also open to that too. And thank you.